Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidelia. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. You almost caught me sipping coffee. I've got a real good Donut House K-cup here, and boy, I'm about halfway through it, so I may get caught again somewhere during the show. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen, and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Johnny Cash, as we always do, for taking us on that marvelous trip by voice across the United States. And I want to try mapping that out sometime. I think I'm going to do that. Actually map out, somebody maybe has already done on the web, all the different cities that he goes to. But remember, the man used to sing that song without any lyrics to look at, and that's not easy to do. That's a guy with a pretty good memory, wouldn't you say? And, you know, I didn't have a real good memory, so I wrote a book on memory skills to help me. It helped a lot of people across the country, too, I'm told, who later bought the book. But thank you very much. We want to thank Audrey, of course, Mike Sorrento, Lucy Spears, our technical people that get us up and running. And one of these nights, I'm actually going to try using that Direct Connect, where I could use the computer. I always broadcast from my cell phone. I get used to that because I would do it, you know, from remote locations once in a while, and I guess you could do the same thing with a computer. But I'm going to check up on that and see what actually happens. But anyway, the purpose of the show is to discuss issues, news, events, and major developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And it certainly is humorous at times, and we need some of that in the field of criminal justice. We dedicate the show to our criminal justice professionals who still are out there working day in, day out, night in, night out, to protect us, and we should be very grateful for that as they work in the fields of policing, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice at all levels of government, federal, state, and local. So we try to look inside the life of professionals and see what they do out there on the job. One of the things I'll comment tonight on a news story, which kind of disturbs me. I'm sort of a tech person, you know, used to build computers and all that stuff, but I don't like this overreach in terms of monitoring our criminal justice agents. And, you know, we're at the point now where we think we need to watch, record, you know, everybody in the world. And as soon as I get my Google glasses, I'll be doing that to everybody else and see how they act. but anyway, we got some stuff going on in law enforcement. Cops didn't like the dash cams very well at first, and they sort of accepted now. Now they want them to wear body cams. I'll wait just a moment here to comment on that when we get to that particular news story. But anyway, you can work off of Blog Talk Radio yourself and just think of it. Who knows how many years I've been doing this, but just think of it at no cost. You can broadcast to an unlimited number of listeners worldwide. You could go to Blog Talk Radio right now, shut off my show, and go to blogtalkradio.com and sign up, and probably in 3 or 4 minutes you could be broadcasting around the world. Now, you might later want to set up some audios and things like, you know, I got Johnny Cash and other people, you know, but anyway, it's a great service, and if somebody woke up and who passed on in 1975 or 1980, they wouldn't believe it that something like this could ever happen. You know, having a radio and a radio station was a major deal back in the Ice Age. Most of you can't remember that, but I can because I'm that old. All right, we have a blonde joke for tonight, and I'm going to do the blonde joke if you don't mind. It's kind of an interesting one. A friend of mine is taking off to Disneyland, and here's the blonde joke for tonight. It says, two blondes had driven across the country to see Disney World in Florida. As they approached it and got onto the final stretch of highway, they saw a sign saying Disney World left. After thinking for a minute, the driver blonde said, oh well, we'll leave, and they started driving back home. They started driving back home because they thought Disney was gone. Okay, thank you very much. I love that one. Now we got to listen to the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms. You know, it's very important because they have their work is to try to get everybody disarmed so we'll have a safe society. And you may be a little bit tired at this point about election news last night, but what a knockout on the part of the Republican Party over Democrats across the nation. I mean, look at the state governorships map of red versus blue across the nation. But and I'll have a news story about this tonight, but all of the people, dozens of people who were for tighter gun controls and taking guns away from people, they all lost across the nation, and the people on the other side virtually won. So the Ohio Coalition would like you to pay attention to this important public service announcement.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Okay, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. And ladies and gentlemen, we need a green tip. You know, the planet's getting warmer. It doesn't feel like it, though. It's November. It feels like it's getting cooler, but that's the season, so I'm sure it's probably getting warmer, although some major research has showed that it hasn't got any warmer since 1996 in terms of whatever you're measuring. But don't tell Al Gore that. He still has billions more to make. But here's one that's pretty good. If you want to reduce your carbon footprint and feel healthier about it also, don't walk on coals at your buddy's cottage barefooted. Okay, that one's not so good, but anyway, we'll say it's good anyway. I think it's funnier than that. Okay, shut up, Mike. You always laugh like that, and it disturbs our listeners. But anyway, that's it. Let's take a look at some of the news tonight. And again, I've got a long list of them. I usually have 3 times more than I can cover, and I don't like to hurry over those, but I probably do that every evening. But let's take a look at some of the news that we've got tonight to look at. And the first one I'm going to talk about is Iowa. And it's a long story, but the Iowa prison population is set to grow by like 39% by 2024. And of course, this is not a news story. Every state prison population has grown, and then they let them out and never. But anyway, a new state forecast projects Iowa's prison population could grow by 39%. That's over the next 10 years. And the number of inmates would total up to about 11,317. And that would significantly increase the design capacity of existing state penal institutions. This is only a 34-page report. I'm going to try to read that one, actually, because I'm very interested in prison growth and that sort of thing. But planning projects that the male inmate population would exceed the prison system by 37%. Now, they said the State Department of Corrections spokesman, though, Fred Scaletta, said the new projections follow past trends, and there does not appear to be a need for a new prison construction plans, given the success the agency has had in managing the prison and community-based correction system. I'm going to ask you folks a question. What would you think if your prisons are crowded and overcrowded, what would you think would be the major way that prison systems reduce the crowding? I'm going to hold off on the answer, but we'll go on. So we've been able to stabilize and lower our prison population over the years. What they do is they let people re-enter sooner than their release date. What an idea. In other words, these criminals that we've locked up, got to remember, most of them who've been in prison, majority have been there before, so they're just not nice guys that stumbled into something, or women. And so they're going back to prison again, and what we're going to do is let them out again, tells them that, if I get caught again, it's not going to be too tough, so I'm not going to have much of a deterrent by sentencing to keep me from committing crimes. Is that correct? I think that's the way I would look at it. But anyway, the I report goes on and on and on, and increases in paroles, decreases in the average time served before release, and increases in new aggravated misdemeanor prison entries were listed in the report as factors that are helping to reduce prison growth. So there was, now we can, I guess they're talking about changing felonies to misdemeanors. Hey, real serious crime, you know, guess if a person does a home invasion, breaks in, robs your house, takes away stuff away from you personally, we could probably reduce it to, shoplifting or something, and you would just go to a local misdemeanor prison. I think that's another word for a jail, but I'm not sure how the Iowa system is set up. But isn't that interesting? Speaking of going to prison and not staying very long, I have a picture here of a gentleman. He's California State Senator Rod Wright. He's appearing in a Los Angeles courthouse during a September 3rd hearing. He has been sentenced to 90 days in jail for lying about residents. The senator, who resigned his seat after being convicted of 8 counts of perjury and voter fraud, he was sentenced to 90 days in prison. He's been freed before he even entered the jail system. He was convicted in January, 4 years after the L.A. County Sheriff charged him with lying about his address on his voter registration and campaign documents and then voting fraudulently in 5 different elections. I can't imagine a guy doing that. Anyway, he never even got to the jail, and they served his time, and then they turned him loose before he even got behind bars. And guess what? In California and Los Angeles County, that is not unusual. A lot of people are not serving 100% of their time because of overcrowding, says the prison spokeswoman Nicole Nishida. Isn't that interesting? So now, if you're not a congressman or a state legislator, would you get the same treatment? Sounds like you would. Sounds like you actually would. This is the one we're going to talk about tonight. Our major topic is going to be life sentences for juveniles and the debate on both sides of that issue. There's some things about that you might be surprised to hear. But anyway, this is about a 17-year-old boy, Cooper. He's been involved in 2 home invasion robberies, secondary felony robbery. He is ordered to serve 2 concurrent terms of 1 to 15 years. Concurrent means he serves them together, of course. So he might serve 1, he might serve 2, whatever. So they're not consecutive. So anyway, he could be let out at any time. He gained national attention because after the case was moved from juvenile court to adult court, Judge Ernie Jones went against pre-sentence report recommendations and a plea agreement between defense attorneys and the prosecutors. Judge doesn't have to follow those. That's what a judge does. The two sides had agreed to recommend a sentence of some jail time, followed by probation, but the judge gave him these sentences in prison. Well, what happened on Tuesday, he had his first hearing before a member of the Utah Board of Pardons. This is Ogden, Utah. It usually takes the full five-member board up to 2 weeks to vote on something to grant parole to an inmate. They didn't. They granted him parole right away, so he's out. And they said, oh, he's really a nice kid. He said, here's some quotes here about him. Cooper, he and four others committed an armed robbery at a Roy home, Roy, Utah. The group held two people at gunpoint and demanded drugs. But I think his father said, well, you know, he didn't really hold the gun. He was hanging out with the wrong crowd. I mean, I guess if you're hanging out with the wrong crowd and they're doing a home invasion robbery, can you kind of figure out maybe how to go out the door and call the police? He didn't do that. But anyway, he's out. What else can we learn from that? Here's the idea about the cops wearing body cams. There's two sides to the story. My side of the story is if you have a person in a police uniform who has gone through the most rigorous selection process of any job in society, you say, no, Haley, that's not true. It is true. They go through 15, 16, 18, 20 different steps. Usually it's successive hurdles. You don't pass this one, you don't get to the other one. You take on this position of police officer called a position of honor and trust. They work out in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, without anybody watching them. It's a position of honor and trust. Now we want them to wear body cameras so that everything gets recorded. And there's another bad side of that is the cops can now say, hey, you're on camera. And maybe the citizen will straighten up a little bit and act a little more decently and submit to an arrest or whatever's necessary in that particular circumstance. But a lot of these officers are against this idea. I'm against it. The ACLU generally takes a pessimistic view of the spread of surveillance cameras across America, but it favors body cams for cops. You know, that might change as these cases come down. And, of course, who loves this best? But you're right, Mike. The people that like it the best are the people who manufacture body cams. I mean, they want to sell these things and give you the network set up for them and the whole bit. But I don't like the idea of the body cams personally. If we have a person in a position of honor and trust, then, you know, we ought to be able to trust them until they prove that we can't. Would it help in a few cases, relatively speaking? Of course it would. But in most cases, we don't need to film everything a cop does out on the street. This is one I can't believe. I didn't know anything about this. I'm dumb about these kind of things. Ford police cruisers are now coming out with all kinds of things. It'll catch the cops driving like a jerk, double parking, blocking traffic, cruising down the highway beyond the speed limit. By the way, if you're going to be a cop, you're going to learn how to do all that, or you won't be able to catch people and save lives. Blatantly texting while driving, all this. 50 Los Angeles Police Department cruisers have been outfitted with transmitters that send officers' driver's information to their supervisors and even tell if the boys in blue or women are wearing their seatbelts. So Ford is building this into their police cruisers. It's called Ford Telematics for law enforcement, and I guess Ford's probably going to make some money on that, right? It'll take care of it. It looks for hard braking, sudden acceleration. Hey, sudden acceleration, isn't that kind of normal police work when you're getting there to help somebody or something happens on the spur of the moment? But again, this is part of that lack of trust of cops. Do some cops violate that trust? Yes. But most of the time we're able to catch them and, if necessary, prosecute them, and some do jail time. I mean, it's not unusual to have a cop in jail. What we're talking about after this long selection process, a very small number of folks. I couldn't possibly read all these, but as the election returns came in on November 4th, one thing was evident. The the Second Amendment crushed gun control candidates in Senate and gubernatorial races around the country. And I'm telling you, we've got, we have a list of their, oh my gosh, this list must be 40 or 50 people that, you know, take Purdue and all these governors that won, they were all for allowing you to keep your guns, and all the people they ran against, most of them didn't. But anyway, look for that story. You can get that on the internet. The title of the article is called Second Amendment Crushes Gun Control Candidates in Midterm. I think this one is also on Drudge. I don't have a record here. What paper this? Oh, yeah, it's Breitbart News. Breitbart News. You can go to Breitbart, conservative site, and he'll list all this stuff. Nobody ever accused him of being wrong. But all these lists of all these people that won, and they were NRA endorsed or something like that. So the heck with all that junk, right? this is kind of interesting. I'll finish. Well, I got three more to go. I've been to Romania many times, and one of the things they got over there, they had a former commander of a communist prison in Romania who was charged for the torture and deaths of 12 inmates, has told a court that he was only following orders. Alexandru Vizisinescu, 89, is charged with crimes against humanity when he ran the notorious Sarat prison from 1956 to 63. He appeared agitated when the widow of former inmate General Jan Eremia testified how her late husband lost 110 pounds and was denied medicine in prison. Ceausescu and his boys, the crooks that were the dictators in Romania, they put in prison about 500,000 Romanians, were held as political prisoners in the 19th. Can you believe that? 500,000 people were political prisoners while the communist government sought to crush all dissent in that city. And I've mentioned before, Romanians love freedom. Okay, let's talk about filthy TV this fall. Have you noticed some of it? I mean, it just disgusts me. This first report was reported November 14th issue of Hollywood Reporter, the current issue. The season broadcast TV isn't for the prudish. Nearly 2 months into the fall season, it clears that explicit dirty jokes and boundary-pushing storylines are changing the definition of what sexual content is. Out are love triangles and awkward dates. In are jokes about anal sex, fisting, teen masturbation, and this has all been found by the Parents Television Council. And I can't, what in the world is next? I mean, last week I commented about that stupid DirecTV ad where the three or four guys are standing at the urinals talking about, I guess, DirecTV, whatever. But they go through these different stories and these different episodes and give you some of the filthy junk that's on those. And, well, what in the world is your nine-year-old child doing? And then here's a quote on it, and one of these shows is, he did things to my A, blank, blank, that made my eyes water, and ended an episode with Viola Davis asking, why is your P, dot, 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 on a dead girl's phone? I mean, can you believe this garbage? I mean, we need to put this on regular television, and they're doing it. I can't believe it. Hey, don't drive when you're sleepy, right? New study came out, AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety. It's out with new research that shows that 21% of fatal crashes involve tired drivers. Do any of these systems, my thing's got sonar and all kinds of junk on it, the vehicle that I drive, but do any of these things actually wake you up if you kind of fall over or not? I think there are things like that, but I don't know much about those. But that's something, isn't it? You're talking about one-fourth of people, and a lot of people don't like to admit that they get dizzy, I mean sleepy, while they're driving. And they said the young people are more likely to admit it than other people, but it was based on the analysis of 14,268 crashes in 2009 to 2013, in which at least one vehicle was towed away from the scene. But you've probably seen people, you know, nodding off a little bit and going over the white line on the side of the road. No, well, aren't those little groove white lines on the right side? Wasn't that a great invention? I mean, you actually see people kind of wake up and stop texting when they start hearing, you know, so I think it's a great idea. Anyway, that's it for the news tonight. Kind of hurried through some of that, but let's go ahead and take a look at this whole business. So take me just a second here to get set up. We're going to be listening to Professor Kara Drenan, she might pronounce it that, C-A-R-A. She's from Catholic University Columbus School of Law, and she's going to be talking about life sentences for juvenile offenders. You think, well, what in the world will we be doing that for? Well, she'll be telling you about some of these cases. And let's give me a second here to get set up, and we'll be listening to it. Hold on.
Be subject to life sentences to help do that. We're joined at our desk by Kara Drenan, an associate law professor at Catholic University who has written on this subject. And Ms. Drenan, maybe the best way to get into this subject is talking about the case of Terrence Graham. Who is Terrence Graham and how did he influence the public debate on this subject?
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me this morning, John. So Terrence, I have a lot to say about Terrence. I've come to know him personally in my research, but let me start with just the facts of his legal case. At 16, Terrence was convicted of participating in an armed robbery, and in Florida at that time, he faced up to life without parole for that offense. The sentencing judge in his case gave him 3 years probation. He allegedly participated in another armed robbery. The state actually never pursued that crime, but instead pursued the fact that he had violated the terms of his probation. A different sentencing judge then imposed that suspended life without parole sentence. So at the age of 17, Terrence Graham was sentenced to die in Florida prison. His case ultimately percolated up through the Florida courts and to the United States Supreme Court. And in 2010, the court said that under the Eighth Amendment, life without parole sentences are impermissible for juveniles who commit non-homicide offenses like Terrence.
And this wasn't the only case that the Supreme Court took up involving life sentences for juveniles. There was a 2012 case as well, correct?
That's right. So the 2010 decision actually applied to a relatively small group of inmates in the country. So Terrence was one of what the court at the time estimated to be about 125 inmates nationwide. Ironically, 77 of those inmates were in Florida. So query what's going on in Florida, but... So 2 years later, the court answered the lingering question, which was, okay, well, you know, that applied to a small subset, but there's a big group of inmates serving juvenile life without parole for homicide offenses, and that's the 2012 case you referred to. In Miller versus Alabama, the court said even in homicide cases, juveniles who commit those offenses may not be sentenced to mandatory life without parole. So the Miller opinion leaves the possibility of life without parole on the table. It's not a categorical rule. But it does say that states cannot mandatorily sentence juveniles to that.
Kara Drenan, an associate law professor at Catholic University, you've written a bit about this subject, specifically how states have responded to these 2010 and 2012 rulings. What are we seeing from the states?
I guess not surprisingly, we're seeing a split in what states are doing, particularly in the wake of the Miller decision. As I said, that decision impacted a far larger population of persons serving juvenile life without parole, around 2,500 inmates nationwide, and those inmates are concentrated in five particular states. So just within those states, a good, I think, counterpoint are California, a state that has said we will treat that decision as retroactively applicable and give all juveniles who are serving a life without parole sentence a second look, if you will. Contrast that with a state like Pennsylvania, where the state Supreme Court has said the Miller decision will not be retroactively applicable. It has introduced and passed legislation to impose new mandatory minimums in lieu of life without parole, or at least as an alternative to life without parole. But we're seeing very different responses from the states.
Some stats for our viewers that we can show you. 2,500 young inmates in the U.S. Sentenced to life without parole in prison. Most of them are in five states: Pennsylvania, Louisiana, Michigan, California and Florida, some stats coming from some of the work you've done on this subject. If our viewers want to talk about juvenile life without parole, this issue that stems from Supreme Court cases and playing out in states around the country, phones are open. Democrats can call it 202-585-3880, Republicans 202-585-3881, Independents 202-585-3882, and if you're outside the U.S., it's 202-585-3883. While folks are dialing in, Mr. Einem, I want to ask you about how much...
This is a C-SPAN recording, so those numbers don't work for you. Okay.
Making decisions regarding life without parole. We hear a lot of the term of juveniles being sentenced as adults or treated as adults mm-hmm. for certain cases. How do the rules apply?
How does that work? Right. So there are a couple of ways in which that works. In the 80s, many states passed legislation that enabled juveniles convicted of, or charged rather, with certain offenses to be transferred to the adult court system. So that's one way in which states have dealt with the issue. Certainly in the Graham case, for example, there were 39 pieces of legislation that were affected by that decision. 39 states permitted juveniles to be immediately transferred to adult court and if convicted, sentenced to life without parole. In the wake of the Graham and Miller decisions, that legislation, at least with respect to non-homicide offenses, is now unconstitutional and needs to be amended. In the wake of the Miller case, there's a lot more controversy about what the states can get away with, if you will, because that was not a categorical rule, but rather said states need to follow certain procedures if and when they're going to dole out life without parole sentences.
And the other issue I wanted you to explain a little bit more was sort of the retroactive application of some of these laws between the rulings, the 2010 ruling and the 2012.
Right, sure. So the retroactivity question is actually a very complex legal one, but I think the easiest way to think about it is to think about the question being one of who gets to benefit from these decisions. The 2010 decision, it was very clear. The court made clear that it was a substantive rule, meaning that it was taking off the table an entire sentence for an entire category of offenders. The Miller decision has generated a lot of debate around the question of retroactivity. I would imagine the Supreme Court will ultimately have to readdress that issue squarely. So in the Miller case, the question is in fact, should those 2,500 inmates I mentioned, do they get a second look, if you will, a reassessment or a parole hearing, or should it only be juveniles who commit homicide offenses after the court's 2012 decision? Should they be the only defendants who get to avail themselves of that Miller ruling?
Several folks waiting to talk to you about this subject as we discuss juvenile life without parole sentences. Ray is waiting in Newark, California, on our line for Democrats. Ray, good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if what we know about child development, if any of those actual facts are taken into consideration when these laws are made, and should they be. We know that the male human brain, as an example, you know, isn't fully developed until sometime in the early 20s. Trying a child as an adult, you know, has some, you know, real implications as far as, you know, whether they're able to make decisions, are they able to, you know, weigh choices and this type of thing. And then the other thing is, you know, I wanted to know how many of that 2,500 are Latino and Black, and I'll listen off the air.
Great. So I think two important points that the caller raises. The first is the laws that have been overturned by the Graham and Miller decisions, I don't think took adequate account of the difference between juvenile and adult brains. In the 80s, criminologists had advanced a super predator theory, and the fear was that there would be a wave of criminal activity among juveniles. That theory has since been debunked. And now there continues to be a developing body of brain science that tells us juvenile brains are, in fact, quite different from adult brains. The caller is correct to note that science indicates it's mid-20s by the time the portion of the brain that controls risk assessment, impulse control, long-term planning, before that is fully developed. So while I think the laws at issue, the laws that need to be reassessed, while those laws did not take the brain science into account, the Supreme Court certainly has taken that into account. And as early as 2005, when it held that juveniles cannot be sentenced to death in this country, and then in 2010 and 2012, the court has taken very seriously and has adopted that brain science and has said children are different in the eyes of the law and our sentencing practices need to reflect that. The second point that the caller raised was one of racial disparity. I don't have good numbers on the Latino and Black population subpopulations within that 2,500, but across the board within our incarcerated population, it is true that Black and Latino communities are overrepresented in that population.
Which brings up Dean's question.
Well, there's a reason why they're overrepresented, and that's been studied for decade after decade after decade. The number one cause of death of young Black males is homicide. Think about that, what that means, the families that lost their child.
David, waiting in Auburn, New York, on our line for Republican. David, good morning. We're talking about juveniles and life without parole sentences.
Yes. Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to say is, you know, I'm 55, and when I was growing up, the basically was, you know, if you did a crime, it was minimal. You did your time. And the part was, a lot of times is if you did a more serious crime, like car theft or anything else, the judge would say, do you want jail or do you want to go into service? Which is unheard of today, which they should do. But you look at the...
I never said that about the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps wouldn't take them.
He's deterrent for everything. Justin Bieber gets arrested for DUI, smoking pot, drag racing in a 30-mile-an-hour zone because he has money with a Lamborghini. How could his bail, if he smiled in front of his with his mugshot, how does this guy get a $2,500 bail? When this guy is worth millions of dollars, and if you and I did it, the bail would be $50,000. You see, you have to have, for every action, there's going to be a reaction. So you have to educate people that there has to be a deterrent. Okay, and I'll take my answer up here. Thanks.
So I think the caller raises, again, a couple of important issues. One, the Justin Bieber example, I think, points out the fact that there is great disparity in our criminal justice system in terms of fairness and outcomes. Clearly, Justin Bieber has access to both financial resources and legal counsel that someone like Terrence Graham or Evan Miller did not have, and that's clearly the case. Over 80% of people in this country who are prosecuted for a crime are poor, and they are not the Justin Biebers of the world. So I think those are two very different scenarios. The caller also mentioned the question of deterrence. And I think that brings us back to the brain science, which tells us that juveniles, again, are not able to process and plan ahead and think through the consequences of their actions.
Does this law professor actually believe that that's new information? The School of Criminology started at Berkeley back in the early 1900s. It's not new ideas.
Lynn writes in on Twitter with a question, how does U.S. law compare with other countries on this topic?
Yeah, pretty abysmally, and that's a source of controversy among the sitting justices on the court, but in terms of our use of life without...
Will someone tell this professor that we have the lowest crime rates we've had in 50 years, and the overwhelming answer for that statistic is we locked up the criminals.
Or have it on the books. Only two, in fact, actually utilize juvenile life without parole. That is the United States and Israel. And there's a growing consensus, I think, in the international community that this is just unacceptable, that it violates basic human rights.
Go to Bus Waiting in San Diego, California, on our line for Independence.
Murdering someone doesn't violate their human rights?
Great topic. In fact, I was just reading a few days ago, and I don't know if these numbers are correct, it's what I read, that we have over 20 million people incarcerated in this country right now. It's an all-time high, not only for numbers-wise, but percentage-wise of our population.
That's a great
rate. Ask yourself, what has changed, especially here in California? We've privatized our prison system, so there's incentive, there's money to be made by putting people in prison. And my question to you is, how much do you think that has an impact, why we see these long sentences to people, where they're just throwing them in jail and they're throwing away the key, and it's because, in my opinion, and I don't know if it's yours, is that people are making money on it. I think we need to go back to where we used to be, where prisons were run by our states, by our counties, by our, I know federal prisons are still federal, but they've outsourced this, and people are making a ton of money on it. Let's see what your take is on that.
Yeah, so a lot of important issues in that call, so thanks for that. The numbers are actually not as dire as you said. There are about 2 million adults and children incarcerated in this country at this point. It is nonetheless at an all-time high, and it does mean that on a per capita basis, we have one of the highest incarceration rates in the world.
There's so only 199 million.
We have a mass incarceration problem, as the literature refers to it. What has changed? The caller asked what has changed. I think what has changed are two things. First, in the 80s, again, dating back to a period when there was a sort of tough on crime, political rhetoric, fear of the sort of emerging super predator, states enacted laws that added more crimes to the books, number one, and extended the length of the sentences that those crimes carried. And so you couple those things together, and what you have is a ballooning prison population. Caller was in California, I think, mentioned California, and California is a great example. Now under Supreme Court order to reduce its prison population because it's facing just extreme overcrowding. So I can't speak. I'm not really an expert on the issue of the privatization question, but I know there is growing concern about that because obviously there's an incentive to keep those beds occupied if you are a private company that's built a prison.
I've written about it before. It's cheaper than having the public prisons.
Jay Cornell writes in that I'm blown away by the inhumanity of the juvenile justice system. James writes in, if there's a pattern of violence, I'd say send them away for a long time, but if it's a one-off thing, don't throw the book at them. And then one other comment from Linda, who asks, does a crime committed by a juvenile hurt the victim less? What about victims' rights?
Hey.
Yeah, so there's a lot in that. What about victims' rights? So let me start with that one, and then I want to come back to the repeat offender issue. On the victims' rights issue, I feel that that's something we need to be very sensitive to in this entire dialogue. Anytime someone in our community suffers at the hands of a violent crime, that's a tragedy, and obviously an extreme tragedy for the family of that victim. So we need to be sensitive to that. I would say two things on that count. One, in working with nonprofit organizations that are dealing with and seeking age-appropriate sentences for juveniles, and learning that there's actually a great deal of difference of opinion within the victim advocacy community. So not all victims or victims' advocates are seeking retribution, but instead some are seeking restorative justice and closure. And the second point I would add on the what about the victim theory is that as I start in my research to look behind these cases and the legality of the cases, what I'm seeing is that most of these juvenile offenders were themselves victimized in one way or another long before they committed a crime and victimized another person. So I think that's important to keep in mind. In terms of the repeat offender issue, that's clearly a big concern. Statistically speaking, though, almost half of those who are serving a juvenile life without parole sentence are serving that for a first-time offense. And I find that particularly troubling, that we are not necessarily reserving this extreme.
is talking about first-time offense in the adult court where their case was waived to adult court. They probably got locked up in juvenile institutions many times.
What do we know about the ability for rehabilitation when it comes to young inmates versus older inmates?
Right. Well, as I said, part of that brain science that the court has really embraced in its recent decisions says that because juvenile brains are different, if you will, that kids are different, there are two things that flow from that. One is they're less morally culpable because their brains are still developing, and the second is they're more amenable to rehabilitation. So we do know that from a neurological standpoint, children are more amenable to rehabilitation. I think the bigger question, the elephant in the living room, is will the states put up the money that it will take to afford the kinds of services that will really facilitate rehabilitation?
Good. And Mary waiting in San Mateo, California, on our line for Democrats. Mary, good morning. You're on the Washington Journal.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I get concerned when there are sweeping changes made. For example, you said that the Supreme Court is embracing brain science in terms of juvenile offenders who are not morally culpable, but perhaps what we should look at, too, is raising the voting age. You know, if they're not able to make good decisions, then they, you know, it seems to me that they shouldn't be able to vote. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair point. The discussion has tended to flow in the opposite direction, where juvenile advocates have said, wait a minute, in all other facets of our society, whether it's the ability to buy alcohol or tobacco or to vote or to enlist and serve in the armed forces, we draw a hard line at ages such as 18, whereas in some states, prior to these decisions, it was literally permissible for the state to transfer, theoretically, a six-year-old to the adult court system and then have that right. child face a mandatory life without parole sentence. So I think the caller makes an interesting point. It's traditionally in the discussion.
You're also an adult in a few other states. You don't have to wait to 18. You're an adult in Texas at 17. And I think one of the northern states might even be 16.
First, I think that mandatory minimums are inappropriate in the juvenile context. Most jurisdictions now have mandatory minimums in place, and in fact, even those jurisdictions that have amended their legislation in the wake of the Miller decisions have replaced mandatory life without parole with new, and in my opinion, steep mandatory minimums. I would prefer to not have mandatory minimums attached to juvenile proceedings so that the juvenile can be treated as an individual and have their youth, their environment, any other relevant mitigating factors taken into account. And then I think also we need to be cognizant of the mode of incarceration. If there is going to be incarceration for a juvenile offender, what is that modality? And studies indicate that juveniles who are housed in adult prisons are at serious risk for sexual assault and other forms of violence. But I think we need to take a multi-pronged approach to that.
Let's go to Mary waiting in Cincinnati, Ohio now on our line for Republicans. Mary, good morning.
Good morning.
You're on the Washington Journal. Go ahead.
Yes, I just need to talk to Tara in more in depth than I would like to write to her. And could I have the address for Catholic University, please?
In terms of the web address for Catholic University, I believe the law school is just law.edu. Is that
yes,
correct?
It is. We have.
I can't do computers right now. I have to write to her. And I just need the zip code and address of Catholic University, where she's at.
Is that something you feel comfortable
with? Okay, sure. It's a publicly available address. It's CUA Law, Catholic University of America Law School. And we are at 3600 John McCormick Road, Northeast, Washington, D.C., 20064.
John McCormick Law. What was the zip code?
20064.
stay on the line.
Go
ahead.
My question is too long, really, and it's very important.
All right, Mary, stay on the line, and we can help you get that address if you didn't get it. But we'll go to Bruce waiting in Baltimore, Maryland, on our line for Independence. Bruce, good morning.
Good morning. Hello?
Bruce, you're on the Washington Journal.
So, you know, I get tired of the rhetoric sometimes. It's absolutely ridiculous. Let me lay out a few things here real quick. So, you know, I understand as an adolescent, as a young person, that sometimes you don't have the maturity to reason things through. But sometimes that's used as a cop-out. Particularly what always happens is they always turn it into a racial issue, into a discrimination issue. It's always Blacks and Hispanics are always given leniency, and it's always portrayed as a civil rights and a discrimination issue. But that's ridiculous. I don't care what your skin color is. When I grew up, my parents weren't perfect. And I'll say this, as an adolescent, I probably did some immature things too. But by the time I was 9, 10, or 11, I understood some basic premises of how wrong it is to do a violent act against somebody. But yet, what happens is the progressives always sell it this way. I get tired of it.
And I'm going to let Kara Johnny jump in to respond as we talk about juvenile life without parole. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think what I would say to that is even the Miller Court in its decision where it held that juveniles cannot face a mandatory life without parole sentence, even the Miller Court would agree with you, sir, in that there will be some individuals who knew right from wrong and who made a terribly wrong decision and who are never going to be rehabilitated to the point where they can reenter society. I think the point, though, is that that's not a decision that can be made by the sentencing body, whether it's a jury or a judge, when that person is 16. And that it needs to be reviewed on an ongoing basis, that it's not acceptable for us to write off a juvenile at 16 and throw away the key.
We talked about the Miller case and the Graham case. Here's a picture of Terrence Graham from an article about his case from The Atlantic. Want to get you to respond to some critics say that the Supreme Court overreached or overstepped on these decisions. In terms of stepping on the sort of legislative prerogatives of the states. Can you talk about that issue?
Sure. So, I mean, again, the argument of overreaching is really one of separation of powers and one of federalism. So there are those who think that this is, number one, a state issue, that states traditionally have had the right to define their crimes and to define the appropriate sentencing for their crimes. And the separation of powers question is one that that this is a legislative prerogative, that courts are not good at prospectively defining crimes, that that's a legislative function. So that's the argument of the overreaching. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it comes down to a fundamental disagreement over the method of constitutional interpretation. You know, there are conservatives who say that the court should not be treating the Eighth Amendment as a tool for sort of modernizing criminal law. A majority of the court, in fact, is saying, no, we need to look to evolving standards of decency. And given what we now know about juveniles, we're going to treat them differently from a constitutional perspective.
A few more comments from our Twitter page. Peg writes in that mandatory sentencing has brought about one strike in Europe.
We created the juvenile court system because we wanted to treat them differently. I wonder if the professor knows that. She must.
There are. They're few and far between, and that's uniform across our incarcerated population. There are women in that 2 million I mentioned, but statistically speaking, particularly in the homicide arena, the inmates are male.
Good. It's Jesse waiting in Muskegon, Michigan, on our line for Democrats. Jesse, good morning. You're on with Kara Drinan of Catholic University School of Law.
Good morning. Give me a little time to explain myself. The criminal is a joke. Now, I'm 82 years old, and I had a good mind. And all of my life, I have been pulled over by policemen for no reason at all. Hear me out, just please. One pulled me over because I had one of those hanging things on my rearview mirror. He pulled me over and I said, what's the problem? So when you have this rearview problem, blocking your rearview mirror on your car and your rearview mirror, it pop up there. I said, well, on the same time, a white lady drives by. I said, officer, this was a white lady was one of them. He said, well, I can't pull nobody over. But anyway, all through my young adult life, I've been pulled over by police for no reason at all. And then one of my son-in-law, he has a veteran license plate on his car. He said, I'm going to the police pulled him to see his veteran license plate. Well, you can go ahead. You won't get a ticket for that.
Well, Jesse, I'm going to let Kara Drinan jump in. Jesse brings up, again, sort of the differences in dealing with different folks, different ethnicities in the justice system.
Yeah, I mean, the caller is obviously referring to the very front end of the system, sort of traffic stops are about as low level as you can get in this arena. But certainly there's concern about racial profiling in that area. A little bit outside of the juvenile sentencing area.
It's been studied for 40 years.
Whether or not an officer subjectively pulls someone over because they are a person of color, as long as that officer has probable cause to pull the person over, the court will not second-guess the subjective motivations of that officer. So.
Okay. She's a law professor, but probably needs to read a little bit more. You don't need probable cause to pull someone over. You can stop someone under reasonable suspicion. And I won't go into detail on what that means relative to a crime or armed and dangerous. Same thing for somebody walking down the street. But anyway, it's an interesting subject, and I find most law professors kind of see it as a new thing. They haven't studied you go to law school, you take one or two criminal law courses, right? You know nothing about the police system, court administration operations, prison operations, or juvenile justice system management and operations. But a lot of them catch on, and the ones that do usually do very well at what they're doing. Well, that's about it for tonight. We'll see you next week, and we're going to ask Squirrel Lynn to sign us off. But take a look and do some reading about juvenile justice. It's not a new area. As I said, we've been doing it a long time. The court started when? I'll let you look that up yourself. But we started a different court system before the turn of the century. Good night, and here's Squirrel Lynn.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. The blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when.